The city's council auditor paints a different picture on profits when it comes to the proposal to sell JEA. That big march for our lives, well, it's up in Washington tomorrow, but look out for several local demonstrations here in our area, too. And Edward Waters College and the Kids Hope Alliance are closer to finding new leadership. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, we've got to look ahead to this weekend's Phoenix Rising Festival in Springfield. All of that coming up, but first, it's Friday. Time to discuss a busy news week. With our Friday roundtable now, as we welcome Mark Woods, columnist for the Florida Times-Union. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly, is here again.
Howdy.
And our own regular contributor, Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have you all here. Lots to talk about this Friday. Everything from the local marches planned across the area tomorrow for March for Our Lives to progress in the search for new leadership at both the Kids Hope Alliance Agency and Edward Waters College. All of that coming up. But our top story this morning, a question. Just how much would a sale of JEA be worth? Not as much as some estimates, it seems. A new report released Thursday by the city's council auditor says Jacksonville looks to net anywhere between $1.7 billion to $5.2 billion if we sell off JEA. That's less, though, than the figures put forward recently by a JEA consultant. The council auditor says while the sale would deliver a big sum of money to the city, of course, in the billions, he warns that that should be balanced against the many benefits of keeping local control over Jacksonville's publicly owned electric, sewer, and water utility. Here's our question to callers. What do you think of this new figure from the council auditor and his caution about balancing profit with local control? Where do you stand on the idea of selling JEA, making it private? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we always welcome your feedback on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Claire Goforth, let's begin with you. As we always disclose when you appear on this program to discuss this, your husband's a JEA employee.
Yes.
We need to make sure listeners know that. That said, you do have a really interesting perspective on this. So what about this council auditor's figure? He's saying, yes, we're going to make billions if we sell JEA, but you need to factor in the benefits to keeping local control, particularly after severe weather, for example.
Yes, I think that the council auditor's report merely shows what a lot of us have been saying all along, that PFM's projections were pretty optimistic. And accounting,
that was a consultant the city hired.
Yes, the city had hired. Well, JEA had hired as well. They've been hired on both sides of this issue. But, you know, the sort of pie in the sky projections that people say, were they right, were they wrong? Accounting isn't a hard and fast science. There's a lot of gray area. There's a lot of different techniques to accounting. Now, I'm not an accountant, but that's what this difference is. I mean, the council auditor, he didn't want to factor in JEA's assets because they're cash on hand, because he said that in the future, that cash may not be available by the time the sale goes through. And then, you know, his point about local control is something that has been echoed a lot among the linemen that I've talked to at these various meetings that they continually show up to, the red shirts as they're being called. And they're saying, no, we are invested in this community as members of JEA, and we care about what happens after a storm. We care about your sewer system in a way that a private for-profit company will not. Now, after Hurricane Matthew, we had CEO Paul McElroy at City Council on Tuesday answering very hard questions about the restoration efforts. And I think that we would be hard-pressed to find a private company CEO who would be as accessible to us or as accountable to us, because the fact of the matter is, if the public doesn't like the CEO's work, they can pressure the city officials, pressure the mayor who appoints the board, who in turn could terminate his employment. And that's an option that would not really be available if a private company took over.
Of course, McElroy has been subpoenaed to appear before the city council to talk about this in just the manner you're describing. Fred Matthews, the city council auditor, Kyle Billy, echoed this, saying it's a stretch to call local control priceless, but it does have considerable value. That said, here are the benefits to selling JEA, according to Billy's report. A huge windfall that could pay down everything from city debt, unfunded pension obligations, improving roads, drainage, other public works projects, and also looking to get new things going, a new convention center, a new downtown entertainment district, more money for the school system, because a for-profit company would pay property taxes that would benefit public education. Lots to consider.
Well, for each benefit, there's a takeaway. While you could see an increase in property taxes from the entity, but that depends upon if they decide to keep the old charter building, the JEA Tower, which they're probably not. And, of course, all the other properties that they own around the area, if they're going to keep that or not. And while they get the school board may benefit from some property taxes, they won't benefit from some capital things that they're able to get, because JEA is a municipally owned entity. So they're going to lose a few million dollars because of that from the state, and they'll get that. But, you know, this was an interesting week, if you love to get into the weeds on this, because there was a five-hour meeting on Tuesday at the JEA, which the board members met, and then the three-hour meeting yesterday at the city council. And the interesting thing about the JEA board meeting was that the board members said they knew nothing about this sale. Nobody told them about this. They don't know how this came up. To a person, all of them said that they didn't know anything about this. They were surprised that this came up. And the only person that even remotely said anything about it was, of course, Mr. Pettway, who's no longer on the board, who mentioned it to Mr. McElroy, who says that's all we ever heard about it. This was a total surprise to us.
Tom Pettway, a major donor to Mayor Curry, as he left the JEA board, Mark Woods, as he cycled off the board, he floated this idea. And ever since, there's been this mad chase through document searches and other avenues to try to get to the bottom of whether this is something that had been discussed in the shade rather than in the sunshine for some time. And so that has contributed, I think, to some cynicism and skepticism among the public about the process behind all of this.
Right. I'm not an accountant either, not going to claim to be one. And numbers kind of make my head spin. But I think that's some of the issue with a lot of folks out there, both other public officials and a lot of just JEA customers, is that they question whether they really are being told what's playing out. And even when they're getting all these numbers, if they feel like they know the whole story or if there's games being played. And I think that's a big issue here, why you're seeing it getting nastier with subpoenas and things that are unusual.
Right. The city council is issuing subpoenas on this now, demanding people testify under oath. A special city council committee has been set up to look at this. Claire, the council is flexing its muscles in a way it hasn't in the past.
Yes, it certainly is. And that really seems to indicate that their distrust with the process, their distrust of the people involved. There was another public notice meeting the other day during which Councilman Gulliford was lamenting that it wasn't a committee of the whole, that the entire council wasn't on that special committee, to which John Crescenbenny, another councilman, fired back, "Well, you are more than welcome to attend any of those meetings, Mr. Gulliford." You know, them using this subpoena power also has implications in a criminal proceeding, because it is possible that if you were found to have been dishonest, to have committed perjury, there could potentially be a criminal repercussion, which is what CEO McElroy told us after he refused to testify he refused the oath at that meeting was that he wanted to consult with attorneys before deciding.
And that's why Mayor Curry's CAO, Chief Administrative Officer Sam Musa, also declined to take an oath.
That's correct. And yesterday I asked Mr. McElroy during media availability if he had consulted with counsel on whether or not to testify, and he said that he had, and he said he had consulted with both OGC, with JEA's attorney, and private counsel, which tells you just how serious he is taking this.
Well, the irony of it is, in the discussions that were had yesterday with the general counsel's office, it appears that that Mr. McElroy and Al will eventually, if not next week, next Thursday, if they may end up testifying. The question was whether they're going to get a private attorney or not. But, you know, even if they get a private attorney, it appears to be the opinion of the general counsel's office that the taxpayers will end up paying for the attorney they get anyway, because they'll be getting the attorney in lieu of their public duty, their official duty. So the taxpayers are going to end up paying for whatever attorney he gets. But it does appear that he's going to they're going to testify. The question that you'll be watching, and it'll be quite interesting because the general counsel informed the council members, you're going to have to ask specific questions. Because with an attorney there, the attorney could object to your question if you ask a wide-ranging question that could be construed as a gotcha.
All right, let's go to lots of calls on our lead-off topic this Friday on the Media Roundtable. What do you think about the new figures looking at how much the city would stand to profit from a sale of JEA? Where do you stand on this? There are pluses and minuses to a potential sale, and it's not necessarily a binary choice, as we're learning, too. They could look at doing lots of different things with this. Lots of moving parts. 549-2937. Julie is in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Julie. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and all the news people there. My comment or question on this is, I haven't seen so far any discussion about the philosophy of private ownership of a public utility. I feel like all this conversation is being framed to, you know, is it good or bad to sell a utility? Even the former CEO of CSX, that never came up. And I think that's the underlying, you know, distrust that it is our publicly owned, it's our sewer, our water, and everything, and that there's no discussion either of what other cities are going through. It sounded, when the CEO was on, it sounded like when the Vero Beach water thing is the privatization of their utility is kind of a disaster. And there was some, you know, underhanded things possibly going on. So anyway, I know this doesn't directly have to do with the money, but just that's the philosophy. I mean, I think the philosophy of Lenny Curry is sell off, everything you can privatize is good. And I don't.
Yeah, and you're getting at a philosophical difference on whether privatization is a good or a bad thing, Julie. Thank you for
but
that.
That's the main thing. Yes, thank you. Okay,
gotcha. And of course, she's also referring to an interview we did on this program the other day with Mike Ward, former CEO of CSX. He is chairing a committee of the Jacksonville Civic Council to study this. And on this program, he mentioned that it's not a binary choice, sell or not sell. They could look at doing lots of different things, leveraging this to benefit that, selling off parts of it.
But and that was discussed in the audit yesterday. But to do part and not to all to do all is equally complicated and could take years. The Vero Beach sale, for instance, has been going on for 6 years. I understand now that they've been trying to get that done. If you sell off just the JEA, the electric part, which I think Mr. Gulliford was somewhat in favor of the other day, you still have the water issue
right.
That has to be contended with, and you have interlocal agreements on top of that.
And her call pointed out too, it's the city's biggest asset, and it is publicly owned. For a lot of people, that's near and dear. For others, they think privatization is fine. There's a divide in your ideology on this thing.
Well, I think that's the key, and that's what folks are looking at. And that's why the question of who started this is so important. Who's going to own up to who started it? And then let's assume that for some reason this thing does get on the ballot. It'll be interesting to see who is going to champion the sale.
Yeah, Mark Woods, can they get a supermajority vote on the city council for this?
I don't know. I really don't know. But I think coming back to the caller's question, I think that's where we started with the idea of local control and Claire talked about. And I think that is a, beyond the dollars and cents, is something to really think about. And how would it affect, you know, with hurricanes? That's a huge issue. Would it both in the preparedness and then in the reaction afterwards and in the dollars and cents of FEMA afterwards? You know, these are things I'd like to see compared to, you know, what played out with FPL in other parts of the state.
And how they responded.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, and they've raised rates on customers after Matthew and some of the private utilities. They had these surcharges because of their cost to the hurricane cost.
And it's also been pointed out that you've got a headquarters downtown, 2,000 employees in that JEA tower making good salaries. I saw someone tweet out this morning, if the city were trying to lure a company to set up corporate headquarters in downtown Jacksonville with thousands of good paying jobs, they'd be throwing out incentives like crazy to lure that type of tax base and put those types of bodies in downtown Jacksonville. What about that too?
Yeah, I mean, that certainly makes an impact on the local economy, those high-paying jobs and the pensions that are available. I mean, these people, if they lose their positions, then they may be faced with going to the private sector, which could lead them to move elsewhere. And then you lose those, you know, people who are contributing to our economy. And another interesting point that has been somewhat touched on this is, how does this affect the pension fund? If you've got a roughly 2,000 JEA employees in the pension fund with roughly 4,000 city employees in the pension fund, if JEA is sold, it's not likely that a private entity would let them remain in that. So then the 2,000 people have left the city pension. What does that mean for the long-term implications on its financial stability?
The city council auditor says this week that Jacksonville could net anywhere from $1.7 billion to $5.2 billion if they decide to sell off JEA, the publicly owned utility, to a private investor-owned utility like a Florida Power and Light or another company. What do you think? Lots of calls. Dave is in Lakewood. Hi, Dave. You're on the radio.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to point out to your listeners that our local economy is a lot like the national economy. We do better when we bring more money in than leaves the economy. That is, you have a favorable balance of trade, so to speak. Every dime in profit that goes to whoever buys JEA will leave this economy. That is not the path to prosperity going forward.
Okay, thanks for your opinion. Lots of people have an opinion on this. It's the big talker this week. Once again, Rick is in Marie Hill. Hi, Rick. Good morning, Rick.
Hi. I wanted to speak against the sale of the JEA, as I've done in the past, and point out a couple of things. One, anybody who thinks a couple of billion dollars is going to sit Jacksonville on Easy Street is dreaming. Number two, the minute Lenny Curry got into office, he formed a PAC, probably before he got into office, and began collecting millions of dollars in dark money from wealthy constituents. And lo and behold, a few months later, he comes up with this scheme to sell the best asset Jacksonville has. He does a couple of things in doing that. One, he eliminates a union. Two, he pays his political debts and rewards his PAC contributors. And three, he gets a few hundred million dollars to spend God knows where, probably with those same PAC contributors. This is not the only thing. The other thing is that utilities are going to have to convert to renewables, and I don't see a private-owned utility doing that. In fact, these privately-owned utilities are spending billions of dollars to influence legislatures to keep that from happening. So it's wrong on a financial sense, it's wrong in a political sense, and it's certainly wrong in a climate sense. It can't be more wrong. And you only have to look to who's contributing to Curry's dark money PAC to find out where this started. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, there's been a lot of criticism of that. A lot of people have questions as to whether or not the large contributors have been pressuring this behind the scenes in order to eventually benefit from the windfall in the form of city contracts, which have long benefited the elite business class of Jacksonville.
Lydia on the west side. Lydia, what say you?
I say something very simplistic. Why does anybody think selling something to a for-profit company makes sense for the people of Jacksonville? I don't want to pay somebody money for them to make a profit and my rates to go up. I don't make a whole lot of money. I am a Jacksonville native. I've never lived anywhere else. Lived my entire life within a five-mile radius. Even if there are things that are messed up in JEA, we should fix them. Selling it is a horrible idea.
All right.
And it should ultimately be given to the people who pay those electric and water bills to vote and decide if it's going to be done. Not some big wigs in an office building or in one room deciding for all of us.
Thanks, Lydia. You know, there is this push on the city council to get a voter referendum on this because the public obviously has concerns. Chad writes on our Facebook page, as someone who has lived in several major cities, I say JEA does a fantastic job post-storm recovery. I've seen lesser storms in areas with private utilities perform terribly regarding service restoration by comparison. So really strong opinions about this. And Mark, if some of the players on the city council get their way, there will be a voter referendum.
Right. And I think the pushback has been interesting because, you know, people love to complain about their utility. My disclosure would be my wife is a former JEA employee, and I'm a JEA customer. Maybe I should disclose that now. But
Most of us are.
Yeah. But it is interesting how people love to complain about their utility, but then when you throw out this idea, people go, wait a sec, you know, I say this, this, and this, but I think our rates are pretty good comparatively. Our response to hurricanes after Irma was pretty good. And they start to think, do we really want to mess with this? And that the callers that you've gotten here are similar to what I've heard from readers. And I think there's a lot of surprising amount of pushback against this idea.
And perhaps those that initially floated the idea, maybe they didn't realize that there would be this type of fierce devotion to the utility.
Maybe not. Maybe they didn't care. You know, they sort of off in their bubble and let the city officials who are handling it deal with the blowback. But Mark's right, and the caller is right. The idea of JEA, I think, it's like your sibling, you know? You can say anything you want about your sibling,
but nobody else better say it.
Well, based upon the comments from the board members that came out on Tuesday, this could all end if the board members would make a recommendation. Since they claimed that they didn't know anything about this, they sat through a five-hour workshop where they were given some of the same information that the city council got the other day. They could take a vote at their next meeting and recommend that they not be sold. They could do that, and that would end this. But if the board members at JEA are going to let this go on, if they're going to let their CEO, who's under their charge, now they hired him, and the consultant who sat next to him that day that gave all the numbers out. If the board members at JEA are going to let this go, we can assume that the board members at JEA want this to happen despite their claims that they didn't know anything about this, because it could stop at JEA and the city council could just take this as information and move on. But if the JEA board recommends this, then the game continues to move. So that's where the game is made. And by the way, half of the members, at least about five or six city council members, sat through that five-hour JEA board meeting on Tuesday. Crescent Benning, President Brochet, several others sat there and watched them go through it. No comment from the city council. They sat through that meeting, which the JEA board members didn't do for the city council. Mm-hmm. So this could stop at the JEA board if they wanted to do it.
But it's Curry's board. I mean, there's only one member of the board that wasn't appointed by the current mayor.
The mayor says he doesn't know anything about that.
He does say that. You're right. He does say that. And he says it repeatedly, and he says it very strenuously in the strongest language possible, and yet people still are asking questions about it because Pettway, who's his biggest contributor, is the one who set this all into motion. And a few months after he took office, he cleared out the board. There's only one person left on it, and I sat through a meeting.
That was a holdover, you
That
mean.
Was a holdover, and I sat through a meeting in which they talked about the battery technology is going to be disruptive in the utility industry. And, you know, they voted unanimously on every single thing that they had done. And I've looked through months of their board minutes. I couldn't find a vote that was less than unanimous. So I don't know that it seems likely the board is going to do anything but what their leader says. I mean, even after the PFM report on Valentine's Day, which most observers felt was somewhat disastrous for JEA, for JEA's board chair, they had nothing but praise for him. They said that he performed admirably, and maybe he did in their perspective.
And as we've learned through Times Union reporting over the last couple of years, that's obviously a public board. All of the commentary is, and the talking points are laid out beforehand. That's a separate story, but we have learned that. But let's move on, because there are lots of other stories we want to talk about this week. The number to join us as we move ahead into tomorrow's big March for Our Lives rallies, that number is 549-2937. And also making headlines this week, marches are planned across Northeast Florida and South Georgia for March for Our Lives. Cities across the country and even the world are holding marches Saturday to call for gun reform in America as students take to the streets in a show of support for ending gun violence. Of course, all this prompted by the shooting in Parkland at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in South Florida. What do you think about March for Our Lives? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Mark Woods, the big local march will be at downtown Hemming Park, but there will be others in St. Augustine, up in Georgia, and around the community.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, because I heard a call earlier this week on the show where somebody called in and said, these kids that, you know, today don't have any critical thinking, why aren't they talking about, you know, the motive of the shooter, what was wrong with the shooter? You know, all they're talking about is guns, and they don't have any critical thinking. And I, you know, wanted to yell at the radio, because, I mean, I've been repeatedly impressed with these kids. And I think about what amount of critical thinking I had when I was 16 or 17 was not a lot, probably. And I think these kids, for what they've been through, have been pretty remarkable. And beyond that, you know, critical thinking, you know, these kids say part of the issue is guns. I mean, if Nicholas Cruz enters there with a box cutter or a knife, there's not 17 dead people. I mean, I think that the caller to dismiss these kids as naive, you know, they're emotional. They lost 17 classmates and teachers. I mean, so that call infuriated me. So I'm glad you brought up this.
Okay. And yes, that call prompted a lot of follow-up calls, by the way, who took another tack, which is what the whole point of this program, to air everyone's points of view. But Claire, go forth your thoughts.
Yeah, to take it further, maybe if it wasn't a box cutter, what if it was a .22 rifle instead? I mean, a lot of those might not have been casualties. They would have just been wounded, which would have been a better result. I mean, it's still a tragedy no matter what. But these kids, from what I'm seeing and what I agree with Mark completely, I mean, I'm just beyond impressed with them. I think that they are very smart to not give up just because the Florida legislature gave a little bit to them. But, you know, they're
first
asking
gun reform legislation in Florida in decades,
which is a nice step in the right direction. But does it go far enough with no ban of these weapons of war, essentially, in the form of the assault rifles?
And Fred, that's what this whole March for Our Lives push Saturday is about. They're calling for a ban on military grade weapons, semi-automatic weapons. We could get into the semantics of that, but that's a general catch-all term. They want a ban on high-capacity magazines. They want much tighter background checks for gun purchases, including closing the loophole around gun shows and private sales.
Well, as these young people, particularly 17-year-olds, turn into 18-year-olds and get to vote, that's at the point where the legislatures will begin to fear them. And right now they have no fear because they don't vote. and many of them can't vote. As they turn into voters, the fear will be there, and hopefully these young people will maintain the fire over the next couple of years and show up at the polls this fall and in the following spring and fall. That's what's going to make the difference.
We're getting calls about that very thing. It's 549-2937 to join the show. Ted is in Mandarin. Ted, you've been on hold quite some time. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. That point about voting is exactly why I wanted to pass along some information that relates directly to that, which is that there is a local move to support voting by mail, and this is one way to encourage people who are new to voting or haven't voted for a while to vote, and it's something that will help in the midterms. And that's going to be part of the March for Our Lives event down at Hemming Plaza tomorrow. Will be people there to register people to vote by mail.
Okay. Thank you for that. And we need to point out to the billionaire Democratic donor, Tom Steyer, the guy, he's a big environmental activist, and he has those ads on TV now all the time, the Need to Impeach campaign. He's a big opponent of President Trump. He's spending millions in Florida to register young voters to elect, this is his goal, pro-gun control candidates.
Yeah, every year at graduation across the state, and I know we've done it a number of times here in Duval County, there are voter registrars there registering high school students right there at graduation. And that year, throughout that year that they're turning 17 to 18, you have them there. So this is an opportunity to take that seriously, and that's really what we have to watch over the next couple of years, whether these young people are going to carry this over, because what the politicians are betting on is that they won't. They'll forget about it. They'll go on to something else.
I was going to say those three things you mentioned, those aren't exactly these radical ideas. Those are,
in particular, the background check,
right,
is that strong bipartisan support for that.
Yeah. John Rutherford, when they had that kind of round table discussion with the president, he brought it up and he said,
and that was on national television.
Yes. All of a sudden I saw John Rutherford is trending on Twitter. Uh-oh, what happened? And it was because he was talking so much.
Yeah, you always worry someone's sick or something.
Yeah.
But it was because of that town hall.
He was talking
so
much.
That meeting, yeah.
He said, you know, I carry a gun everywhere. He said, I'm pro-gun this, but I'm for, he basically laid out why he was for these much stronger
background checks. Yeah, former sheriff, now local congressman. Okay, a familiar voice is on the line. It's Andy Johnson.
Whoa.
Andy Johnson, you've had so many radio shows over the years around town. Thanks for calling in. Good morning.
I'm calling in to brag that as far as I know, I'm the only person in Florida who got an F rating from the NRA. And I'm still
oh, my goodness. That's when you were in the legislature?
A long time ago, before you were born, Rox. Before you were born.
Oh, I think you assumed too much on that one, Andy.
Good morning. Good morning, Andy.
Go ahead, Pat. Andy.
You have all my heroes there together, and you got a good team there. I am happy about this march tomorrow, and in my wheelchair, I'll be in the march tomorrow, too. But I don't really believe that we're anywhere close to any serious gun reform in Florida, not for a long time to come. If we have marches every day from now until November, I think that most of the legislature is under the thumb of the NRA and unwilling to change. It'll take a very thorough cleansing of the legislature for us to get anything done here.
Okay, well, thank you for that opinion. So you believe then that unless there's a complete flip of the Florida State House, that by and large things will continue on as
they are. At least 20 of the House members, at least 10 of the senators, probably a whole lot more than that, because majority are under the control of the NRA, and they won't change their mind. Just if 100,000 people march in Jacksonville tomorrow, they're not going to change their mind just because of that.
You think, though, of the governor and the Republican leadership in the House essentially defying the NRA on at least some of the pieces of legislation that were passed, raising the age for weapons purchases to 21 and other things like that?
He faked us out. He pretended he was standing up to the NRA. But basically, the governor and the president have just been best friends of the NRA, just trying to pacify us with the smallest, tiniest little maneuvers they might make. And the maneuver that Trump offers of arming the teachers with guns, oh, my God, the NRA loves that plan because that just sells guns all over the place. So I don't think we're making a step forward. I think we're mainly moving backwards right now.
All right, that's Andy Johnson on the line. Andy, thanks for calling in this morning.
I mean, there certainly is a perception among many that the NRA has a stranglehold of the over the Florida legislature, specifically the Republican members of the Florida legislature, because it long has used its money to coerce them into doing whatever it wants. If you don't go with the NRA, then they're going to primary you out the next election cycle.
Well, and they've been able to do that largely because voters haven't paid any attention to these issues. These are not the issues. The gun control has not been an issue that, by and large, drives many voters to the polls. So the NRA, like the insurance industry in Tallahassee, they control.
The reverse is true.
Yeah,
if you're very pro-Second Amendment, you vote consistently.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, there is a certain fetish
they vote consistently.
Really into the Second Amendment.
They vote consistently. And they vote in more numbers, apparently, than the opposite side. But the two big, and again, the two biggest lobbyists are the insurance industry and NRA in Tallahassee and I dare say in Washington. But if the voting changes, if the attention of the voter changes, as we can see in some sectors of the state, then I think you will see the voting trend change. Right now, there just doesn't appear to be that happening, and the legislature is not going to meet till next year, so it doesn't really matter down here.
Hmm. Yeah, thanks to the insurance lobby. I mean, with tort reform, if the school is found liable for the shooting in some way, then the students have the luxury of getting even less money.
Exactly.
You mentioned you were impressed with the young generation, Mark Woods. Susie tweets the show, 6 young people aged 16 to 18 are running for governor in Kansas.
Really?
I actually read about that, and I guess they have not been able to figure out a way to legally stop that. So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Twitter, but I think they will be on the ballot.
If they can get, I think they have to get a certain, there's a certification.
If they can get certified.
6,000 signatures or something. I don't know the exact number, but there is a, yes, there's a requirement there, but. Good luck.
All right. Lots of comments coming in on social media and on the phones as we continue on with our Friday Media Roundtable. Due to popular demand, we now are doing our roundtable on Fridays for most of the hour because this panel is so darn popular. I don't know what to say about you guys other than people love listening to you on Fridays.
I think it's the host, honestly.
Yes,
I think so.
Well, it's 549-2937 to join us. Another headline from the week. Finalists are starting to emerge in two big local CEO searches. These are the two places looking for new leadership, Edward Waters College and the city's new agency, Kids Hope Alliance. Let's take these one by one. The Kids Hope Alliance Selection Committee has narrowed down their search to 5 finalists. Leading in the scoring is Jim Clark, the longtime president and CEO of Daniel Kids. He also serves on a number of local boards. If things go the way it looks like they're going to go, Jim Clark will be leading the Kids Hope Alliance. Your thoughts about this panel?
That's a really, when I saw his name, it really jumped out at me. He's been with Daniel for almost, 20 years
yes,
now?
Yes, quite some time.
And to move from that organization, which is quite vast and quite well thought of, to a largely political organization. In its infancy.
It's a city-run agency.
A largely political organization in its infancy. The works are good. But it's rather strange when I saw his name there to do it. I mean, certainly I think he would be great for it. But the other thing was, of course, the name of Joe Peppers, who's on the Alliance, right? He's on the board.
He was on the board of the Kids Hope Alliance,
yeah, but he's no longer on the board.
Yeah.
He's a finalist along with some others. This Kids Hope Alliance was a merger of the former Jacksonville Children's Commission and one other entity. So it's serving the needs of kids in Jacksonville.
Right, which I think is why people say Jim Clark would be a natural. He's local, has all this nonprofit, kids-related experience, where others are from out of town. The questions about Joe Peppers being, highly unusual to be on the board and then up for CEO. So I think, as you said, that it sounds like Jim Clark is the would be the favorite for it.
At this point,
maybe
yeah.
Joe Peppers is just recruiting for Amazon. Isn't that where he currently
works? At Amazon, he works the at Amazon. Amazon Fulfillment Center.
Yeah.
But this is an important hire for the city. Now, this Kids Hope Alliance was created under controversy. Critics said it was rammed through with not enough of due process, but it's here now. So whoever they choose to lead this will be overseeing a big budget, a lot of programs for underserved kids in particular around
town. For kids who really need help in Jacksonville, I mean, we struggle with poverty in this city, and we struggle with economic disparity, particularly in certain parts of town and certain communities. And I hope that the new person that they select for the Kids Hope Alliance is aware of all of that and has some really bold ideas for how to change the legacy of how poverty and lacking opportunity has affected children in our city as they become adults.
Yes, absolutely. Now let's talk about the other CEO search, as the Board of Trustees for Edward Waters College is expected actually today to pick a new president. Nat Glover is retiring. Of course, he led EWC for years, and before that was renowned as the first African-American sheriff in the state of Florida since the Reconstruction era. So who will replace Nat Glover, who that's kind of big shoes to fill, wouldn't you say? Here are the candidates: Sed Sewell, a former provost at Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, and A. Zachary Faison Jr., vice president and general legal counsel at Tuskegee, a renowned school in Tuskegee, Alabama. Fred Matthews, your thoughts.
Well, it is a major hire, and I know that a lot of folks are very sad to see Nat Glover leave there, but it has to happen. He's had a storied public service career, and quite frankly, the ship was righted over the years that he's been there. There's been a period of peace and calm, and very few stories that have come out of there. And the college has been able to do what a lot of people want colleges to do: be a part of that community, be a meeting place. It's done all of those things. The hope here is that whoever the next president is going to be will not take it a step back, as has happened on two or three occasions before Mr. Glover became president. Every president,
it backslid at
certain
points.
It just backslid.
Points.
They had a problem with money. You had trouble with access.
Enrollment
began to backslide. All those things happened. So it's hopefully the board there, which is predominantly African Methodist Episcopal, controls this church. That church controls this school. Hopefully they've gotten some well chosen candidates. They've been vetted by the student body also, so hopefully that input will be there. So we'll just have to keep our fingers crossed.
And let's take a moment to assess the fact that Nat Glover's retiring, John Delaney, UNF president, retiring. They picked a new president. Cynthia Bioto, the FSCJ president, retiring. A lot of talent is sort of leaving the stage, not just in academia, but in other places around town as new faces are coming in. It's just something that's kind of happening all over town.
Yeah, will it disrupt somewhat of the status quo moving forward? I did notice in the Times Union's coverage of the Edward Waters presidential search, it seemed like the most recent meeting with faculty was a little bit contentious. There were some concerns about not having received raises for 7 years. One of the candidates is talking about putting some of their resources into fundraising, which would take away resources from other areas. It seemed like there was a desire among both to increase enrollment in coming years, which can be challenging for any institution. So I'm curious to see what the next iteration of Edward Waters looks like.
Yeah.
And I think these are common challenges for HBCU schools. And so there's always that reading about it, trying to study last night, that some schools have gone for the younger kind of energetic and unproven, or do you go with
the tried and true?
Right.
Well, we'll continue to watch it, but in the meantime, as always, thanks for being part of the Friday show and our media roundtable. Always great to have you. Mark Woods, Claire Goforth, and Fred Matthews. Have a great weekend, you guys.
Thank you.
Melissa.
In a moment, a look ahead to the Phoenix Art Festival in Springfield. That's an event you won't want to miss. We'll be right back.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at waynehogan.law.
Comcast is building a gig speed network providing small businesses across the country with the opportunity to dream gig. Learn more at dreamgig.com. Comcast Business, built for business.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, as gun control advocates prepare for the March for Our Lives, what have we learned about how to prevent mass shootings, gun homicides, or suicides? The scientific research on gun use and removing congressional breaks on studying firearms. Plus, just how likely are you to catch the flu on that flight? All on Science Friday from PRI.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air. Country singer-songwriter Margo Price brings her guitar and plays some old and new songs. Her recent album, called All American Made, includes a song about how her family lost the family farm. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Mark Zuckerberg breaks his silence.
Our responsibility now is to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
More questions for Facebook over millions of profiles manipulated for political gain. Also, the Austin bomber is dead, and Cynthia Nixon says she is ready for her next act in New York. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's a two-day festival in Springfield you don't want to miss. The Phoenix Art District, a cluster of warehouses in the historic neighborhood, is kicking off this big event that also has a capital campaign with the goal of building a new Jacksonville, Florida School of the Arts. Right now, we're talking about the Phoenix Rising Festival with Christy Frazier. She's the founder of the Phoenix Art District. Hey, Christy.
Hi, Melissa.
Good to have you on the show. Also here, Ari Gaskin. She's event coordinator for the festival. Hi, Ari.
Hi, Melissa.
Okay, in a minute we'll talk about everything happening, but first, Christy, explain a little bit about the Phoenix Art District and why this festival's happening.
The festival is a fundraiser for our new school that we're working on. The entire block, it's 4 acres and 100,000 square feet that we are developing to have, you name it, studios, the school, event space, restaurants. It's pretty big.
You have 100,000 square feet of warehouse space, a 4.5 acre campus. You envision workshops, studios, apartments, a cafe, galleries, event space.
Yeah, I'm crazy.
Like the Cork District in Riverside, but even bigger than that.
Yeah. Well, right? I love Cork. I love Cork, but Cork is full and it's, I mean, I love it, but it's closed. You know, it's a lot of artists who have wonderful studios, but I want it to be more public where there's lots of things for the public to do.
And your vision is to position Jacksonville as a leading city in the Southeast for artists.
Absolutely. We have amazing artists here. They need more space.
Need more space.
Need more to show, you know, to
okay.
Give back.
And so when people come out to the Phoenix Arts District, Ari, this weekend, they will get to see this huge space and they'll kind of be part of this amazing weekend long event. What all is on the schedule?
Yes, on Saturday night, starting at 6 p.m., we're going to open our doors to a building that hasn't been seen before. We've had events in other spaces in the warehouse, but this event space has been totally redone. It's been painted, it's been primed, it's been decorated, it's been all set to go for this night. And we're going to have an artist panel. We're going to have the EDP architects talk about their designs and vision for the future of the Arts District. And we're also going to have a fashion show by Bobby Kay, who you are familiar with, Melissa. He's been on the show a couple
times. I've
met
Bobby Kay, yeah.
He is wonderful. He's got a great vision for his show. It's going to be based on the Stonewall Riots, which happened in New York City. And so there's going to be great fashions designed around that.
Okay, so that's Saturday night. Then on Sunday from 10 to 4, a full day of activities, family friendly. People need, it's a big, huge, almost like a block party.
Yes, absolutely.
What all is happening on Sunday?
So Sunday we have art vendors coming out. We've got art demos from glass blowing with Burnt Glassworks to Fire Trove, who's a fiber arts working. We've got woodworking, DHC. We've got all kinds of different craftsmen coming out to do demos and food trucks as well.
Okay. So people can come out either day. PhoenixArtsDistrict.com is the website. Christy, do people need tickets for Saturday night?
They do, but they do. Can get them at the door.
You can buy at the door. Well, yes. That's how this town works.
Yeah.
I know it's so frustrating for event planners when they encourage people to register early, get their tickets early. For whatever reason in Jacksonville, people like to just walk up to the door and buy a ticket. Good that they can do that.
They were a lot less expensive. Was it, a month ago?
Right. But if you're a late comer to this, you can certainly buy a ticket tomorrow night or come out to the Sunday all-day festival. You know, there's been so much good buzz about this, Christy. So kudos to you as
you
sort of unveil this in a bigger way for the whole community.
Thank you. Also, we should encourage everyone to take Ubers.
Yes.
Not just on the Saturday night, but on Sunday. Just we're concerned about parking.
Tight parking.
Very much so.
And the address is 2336 North Liberty.
Right.
That's in Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge arts district. Come on out for the Phoenix Rising Festival, Saturday night and Sunday. PhoenixArtsDistrict.com for tickets and information. Am I missing anything?
You covered it.
All right. Well, ladies, it's good to have you on the show. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be there for part of the weekend. I'll look forward to seeing you there. Thanks for being here. We'll see you
weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed anything this hour, just catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8. And don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new statewide call-in program, The Florida Roundup. A look at the biggest stories statewide from the week. 1A's up next. Keep listening for that. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast, stay tuned for music. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. Whatever you do this weekend, get out and enjoy it. We'll see you right back here at 9 a.m. Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.